Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Test Tubes and Cauldrons, a podcast where we talk about the science behind spirituality. I'm Astra.
I'm Phil.
And I'm Honey.
And this week we have a special guest.
I'm Levi. Hello.
And we're going to be talking about aliens and ufology and how some of it connects to occultism. But before we get into that, let's go ahead and do our what happened on this day. Rather than a what today, I actually think it's more appropriate to talk about a who. Cyril is, I think it's Ponaparuma, was born on October 16th in 1923. He was a chemist, an exobiologist, and a leading authority on the chemical origins of life. He built on the work of Miller and Clayton Urey, studying the chemical reactions in what are called primordial soup experiments. These experiments are those that simulate the earliest building blocks of life, and they attempt to demonstrate that these building blocks, like amino acids, nucleotides, can form a non-living matter. So I thought that was very appropriate for the subject matter of today. But let's get back to our guest, Levi. Welcome. We're so excited to have you. Go ahead and tell the audience and us a little bit about yourself.
Oh boy, how do I describe myself? That's a good one. I guess I'm something of a half-baked ufologist at this point. I guess stumbled a little bit into occultism, which I think is connected in a way. I like the term para-ufologist. I think that's Alan Greenfield, Dr. Greenfield's definition. I think that fits well. Outside of that, though, I am a Buddhist minister. I've gone through seminary, have background philosophy, and I'm here now.
Very exciting to have you. So tell me more. What is a ufologist? Is that what you said?
Yeah. I mean, there's the ufologist is, you know, someone who would study UFOs. Now, that's not a degree. There's no, I mean, anyone can call themselves that. I think if there is a degree, I wouldn't trust it. But I guess the idea of para-ufologist, like I said, Alan Greenfield is a notable occultist and para-ufologist says, hey, look, you know, there was this history in ufology where, you know, it has always been a little bit mixed. You hear a lot about UFOs as, you know, alien spacecraft. There's people who we kind of call like nuts and boltsers. They're people who think that these are physical objects. Aliens are biological beings flying around through space and time. But over time, and even in the past really too, there's always been more nuanced views on that. The para-ufologist is someone who may be open to more explanations. For instance, I much prefer the term ultra-terrestrial to extraterrestrial. I think it opens up a lot more avenues. And I think that the more and more you dig into this really weird cases, the less and less they look and appear to be just some advanced species. They're really weird. So I think the para fits well into that. And it just opens up some avenues of different thought.
We might be getting ahead of ourselves a bit by asking you, but can I ask how you got into para-ufology? It seems quite an interesting thing to, especially the crossover with Buddhism, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've just always been a little weird is really the answer. I remember, you know, it always was something that struck me. I liked ghost stories and Bigfoots, UFOs. I remember back in elementary school, they would take us to the library once a week or something. And just in the back corner of the book section, there were four books that were, I think it was UFOs, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, and I think maybe ghosts. And they were just black and white books. But I check them out every single week because I just thought it was fascinating. I don't know. I've just always been into that weirdness that kind of coincided with religion and spirituality. So I had always had an interest in that, went into philosophy, had met my Buddhist teacher, and I had, you know, become a student, gone through that program, became essentially ordained. And then a pandemic hit and I said, well, I need something to do. So I ended up going to seminary and got my master's in theology. And I studied a lot of things in new religious traditions and interfaith work. And I think all of it just kind of blended together for me. I think it's hard for me to separate them into distinct categories. It's all Fortiana, Fortian thought, high strangeness is the best way to put it.
And I think we're going to be getting into the crossover between Buddhism and these kind of ideas in a little bit. But could I also ask what tradition of Buddhism you are ordained into?
Sure, of course. Easiest answer is Mahayana, Japanese Mahayana Buddhism. My organization that I was ordained or, you know, sometimes use the term inducted into is called the Bright Dawn Center for Oneness Buddhism. It is non-denominational Mahayana, though its root is in what's called Jodo Shinshu or Japanese Pure Land Buddhism, which is where I really would fall in my general belief system. So yeah, it's we have some Zen background. I've done a little bit of work in that with some Zen monks and priests, but I wouldn't call myself a Zen Buddhist. Adjacent, maybe. I have a deep respect for them.
Let's talk about it. Let's go into this crossover between Buddhism and ufology. I'm curious. When you posted it in our outline, I was like, this is an interesting crossover that I didn't know existed. So I'd love to hear where you begin to see the similarities between the field and how it's impacted your spirituality, if it has at all.
The thing is, I guess I'm going to try not to get on a soapbox here because it could be a podcast episode on its own.
You can absolutely get on your soapbox, by the way.
I mean, Buddhism, I think, is actually very popular in America and the West world, but it's not terribly deeply understood. I think people like a lot of the core messages and they find value in it without necessarily, you know, practicing Buddhism. Mindfulness and meditation is everywhere. But Buddhism is very, very interesting. It has a very deep metaphysical, ontological background. People really don't dig into it, or they try to dismiss it. You know, I don't really believe in secular Buddhism. I don't think that's a thing. I think you can practice the ethics, meditation, take whatever you'd like from it. But part of Buddhism is its metaphysical foundations. It's not asking for blind faith, which I think people, you know, get confused with sometimes. These things are part of the tradition. Buddhism is always accepted that there are other worlds. Now, I don't necessarily mean planets, but there are other realities from this one, and the universe is inhabited by other forms of sentience. And this is not a shock to Buddhists. The idea of aliens from another world, I'm not endorsing that. If that was proven, it would not have a crisis of faith in Buddhism. It'd say, yes, of course. If there were interdimensional entities, for lack of a better word, yeah, Buddhism, sure. There are other realms, other realm systems. That's part of the tradition. It's not really focused on because it's kind of one of those, well, all right, cool. How is that going to help you in, you know, the path towards enlightenment and ending suffering? For the most part, maybe it won't. But it's part of the tradition, so it's not a shock. And there are some interesting little crossovers here and there that, you know, I don't like ancient alien it. We're trying to say, oh, look, this is evidence of aliens in the past. Says, well, look, isn't that interesting that this story here or this teaching kind of coincides with something. It looks like there's some interesting similarities in general thought.
Something that you touched on just now was the idea that Buddhism is sometimes seen in the West as a consequence of modernism as a secular practice. And I wondered if you might be able to give us some insight into why that's a misconception, whether there are deities and beings in Buddhism, and how those are kind of seen in different traditions.
Sure. So when we talk about secularism in Buddhism, what I mean is Buddhism with a materialist outlook. And I say materialism is in the belief that the only things that exist in the world is brute matter. And that's just fundamentally opposed to the Buddhist belief. Roshi Metamore, who's a Rinzai Zen abbot here in America, really, really wonderful teacher. Not my teacher, but I respect him a lot. He says, if that secular view there was true, then think of the Buddhist's main teaching. He says, look, life is suffering or life is dissatisfaction. And we want to end it. That's a fundamental truth. Well, then die. That would end it, right? And that's a reasonable thought. You know, if truly you accept that, the life is dissatisfactory in its very nature, why would you want to live? Now, the Buddhist answer is, well, dying's not going to help. You're going to come back, probably worse off. So that's a pretty extreme one there. We look at secular practices such as mindfulness, and you see that without some of the metaphysical foundations, they start to wander. They start to lack. Example is, you know, one say, okay, stealing is against the precept. You don't want to break the precept. It's negative karma, which just means that it's bad. It's a bad action that will have consequences in some way. It's not a divine punishment, but you do something negative, you might get negative results. So really, how much is stealing a lighter from a mega corporation going to do? Not much. So why would I care? Well, the Buddha says, well, look, the karmatic consequences is not necessarily that you're going to harm the corporation. You might harm yourself. You may become more accustomed to taking. Maybe it starts with a lighter. Maybe something more expensive. Then, well, maybe it's a ma and pa shop. Maybe it's someone who's struggling. Well, it's just for me. Well, there's no consequences to it. You know, I'm smart enough to know. That's kind of the idea there. Well, I'm smart enough to not. But the Buddha says, well, not necessarily. You know, these are actions that are habitual. They have a consequence more than just maybe purely psychological. So the idea is the depth isn't there. You never actually will go very far on the path. You can definitely improve your life. So I'm not saying don't meditate, but from the Buddhist point of perspective, it's a bigger project than here and now. And those metaphysical beliefs ground ethical practice and they give a reason to keep doing it. It's very easy to say, hey, look, there's a homeless person starving. Let me become mindful of the present moment so I can ignore them. that's what it ends up. Corporate McMindfulness is a huge criticism, and I think it's pretty evident. So again, I can go on about this, and I'm not trying to shame anyone, but just from the Buddhist perspective, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. The metaphysics grounds the rest of it.
So pulling this back to the idea of other beings, other realms, you talked a little bit about Pure Land Buddhism, for example, which is a strain of Mahayana, as I understand it. So you were talking about the consequences of one's actions. How does that consequence tie into the idea of other realms in Buddhism?
The idea, of course, negative karma will equal negative rebirth, positive karma, positive. Now, I think that sometimes people take things a little bit too literally in terms of like, this will exactly do this. Oh, you do this, you're going to go to a horrible place, or, oh, you're going to go to a good place. Even the Buddha said, look, it's so complex. Karma is not just this life. It could factor into other lives. If you are a very, very greedy person, as a good example, you may be reborn as a hungry ghost, always wanting and desired, but unable to eat. There's the image of the hungry ghost as having this pencil thin neck and this huge belly that is full. You know, you want to consume, but, you know, that's your karma. No one did it to you. Just the idea is your own greed, all the bad stuff about you is going to come back. It's your own mind reflecting. That's one way to look at the realms.
All right. This has been a really great discussion so far. And I'm looking ahead in our outline and I see you talk about the Lotus Sutra and how it sounds to modern ears. And how does that tie into all of this?
So I'll kind of give a very condensed recap of, I believe it's chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra, if I remember off the top of my head, and I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce the Sanskrit name. The story essentially goes that the Buddha is teaching, the Lotus Sutra is a very, very important sutra to pretty much all of Mahayana Buddhism. And the Buddha's teaching, and he's about to give this amazing teaching of the Lotus Sutra. And the idea is that while he's doing this, there's signs and signals giving off because he's in this meditative area. And then this other Buddha, because by the way, in Buddhism, there's more than one Buddha. They're actually infinite if you really get to it. But this other Buddha in a different world system senses that this Buddha is about to give this amazing, really important lesson. And this other Buddha says to a student, hey, on Earth, there's this guy named Shakyamuni Buddha. And he's going to give this rare lesson. You should go listen to it because you're not going to ever hear it again in thousands of lifetimes. But he says, but warning, the people on that world system are really small and they look really weird and ugly. So be careful. So at first, this student goes to Earth telepathically, and then the Buddha senses them as, oh, you know, come over. And so he finally goes physically, and he goes in like a tower that's like a rocketing tower, and it's the sound of a million drums coming down to Earth. And he appears, and he's really tall and weird, and then he has to transform into a human to listen to the sutra. And he does so, and then he says, thank you, and he goes back into his tower and shoots back up to this other world system. Now, of course, again, the point I had brought there is that sounds like an alien, right? Coming to this, you know, this world. And it's interesting that he comes first non-corporeally or through some weird spiritual means. Then he comes physically later. But again, I don't like the idea of always reading the past as, well, that was just an alien. Just no, there's similar archetypal imagery there. It's very interesting that this was something that was thought to be needed to preserve. Now, maybe the scholar better suited in the Lotus Sutra than I would say, well, no, that just shows more that this sutra is so important that other Buddhas come and need to learn about it. Oh, that's reference to a tower is maybe a reference to this, this, and this that's lost on us. Very possible. Just interesting that those archetypal things appear. And no one bats an eye at it in Buddhism. That's not even one of the most important chapters at all. It's just part of it. And it says, okay, cool. You know?
I see this a lot, right? Where people see these myths of people coming from like other worlds and jump to aliens. That's a very common thing. And there's this belief that like the old gods are aliens. I mean, you see this perpetuated by Marvel. Obviously, it's a comic and whatever. Star Trek, it's a very common theme. Again, obviously, those are both not meant to be taken seriously, but you definitely have people who do take that seriously. And then conversely, why we think that misses the mark.
Yeah, for sure. It's a really important topic, especially because you have a lot of popular media talking about it. And you have Ancient Aliens, which has done a lot of things, not many that I think are good. Entertaining, for sure. But yeah, misses the mark. There's a really good book on this called The Supernatural. So two words, super and natural. Visions of the Unexplained. A New Vision of the Unexplained by Whitley Strieber and Jeffrey L. Kripal. I know Kripal is a scholar of religious studies, and Whitley Strieber is a UFO guy. He was the one who had the abduction experience in Communion. He's kind of the archetypal abductee. And they have this really wonderful discussion of someone deeply in the UFO realm and then someone in the religious studies realm. And one of the things they said is that you really can't or shouldn't look back in the past at myths and go, oh, that was all aliens. Those are ancient devices. Because it's completely and utterly ignoring all the context and all of the meaning behind these old stories. You know, so there's, oh, there's, they ride on chariots. Stuff. Well, what does a chariot mean? You know, what does someone riding on a chariot mean? What does it mean to be above in that culture? These are things that have explanations and sometimes more profound than it was just an alien. And at the same time, you see it even now where people are looking at aliens and going, maybe these are the gods returning. Maybe these are, you know, sometimes you see from more conservative evangelical groups, aliens are demons. That's a very common one. They're demons, they're demonic. Or in the New Age world, oh no, the demons are our saviors. Oh, not the demons. The aliens are our saviors. They are all from Pleiades, the Nordics, and the this, and oh, they're at wars with the Greys. And there's this huge religious undertone to aliens that, again, we're putting what was onto the present onto what was. And neither hit the mark very well. They're just always lacking some kind of nuance or context that gives it its actual value.
And one thing, too, that I find really interesting, and we talked a little bit about this in our hypnosis episode about Betty and Barney Hill and how in many ways they were, like, the 50s is really when a lot of, like, modern ufology begins. So I think it's quite odd that people are supplanting aliens as gods onto the past when our modern concept of aliens is very new for the most part.
The thing about it is that some aspects are very new, but I think the shared aspect is that they have very deep archetypal similarities. I mean, going to something like the Fae and alien abductions are so similar in terms of how people discuss them. I mean, I just read one about, you know, I think it was like the 1600s or 1700s about someone, you know, stumbling into a Fae gathering. And the way they describe it is that described by they're encircled and there's this humming, this intense humming, which is the same thing you get in abductee cases that happens before they're abducted. There's missing time, missing memories. Sometimes there's physical ailments. We get the term having a stroke from being fairy struck. I mean, the idea that you do not come out of a fairy encounter unharmed. People come out of alien abduction cases, they have scars, they have weird things happen to their body. The archetypal stuff is there. There's crossover to a lot of it. And I think that's the interesting part. But people want to go, well, no, I don't want the look at the similarities. It's either one or the other. And that's the big problem in my mind.
Something that kind of struck me when you were talking about this and how people seem to want to ascribe everything to aliens, as you were saying, and they're kind of missing a lot of that context, that symbolism, that allegory, is perhaps how mythic literalism seems to be playing a role here. I know, for example, you mentioned evangelicals, and in the wake of the Fifth Great Awakening in the US, so when Protestantism started to split into evangelicalism as a response to secularism rising, you tended to see these New Age beliefs, these more literal understandings of the Bible, for example, were developing. And so in my mind, I can sort of see these things going hand in hand, because a literal understanding of myth that allows you to say, oh, well, it must be some kind of being from outer space rather than something that is a little bit more metaphysical, as you were describing in this kind of para-ufology. So I don't know what your thoughts are on whether this is kind of a product of our secular world or whether I may be just reading too much into this.
No, I think that's a very good point. I think if you see ufology in terms of people who are really, really into the nuts and bolts physical, there are UFOs out there. Look at Congress right now talking about UAPs. Side note, I don't believe any of them. I don't believe anyone from the federal government knows about aliens. I think that there's a great book called The Mirage Men. Since the 50s, I don't trust they know much about it. I think that there's a lot more going on to it. But the point being is that people now, I think you see that there's a building of a kind of secular religion around UFOs, if you will. People are saying they look at the world, they accept materialism as the default. That's the only rational way to look, but they still want a savior. They still want to believe there's more out there. So aliens come in. maybe one day the space people, the space brothers, are going to come down and they're going to fix the mess we've made. Or they're going to abduct me and bring me to Lanulos. They're going to bring me down into Mount Shasta to some paradise. None of it requires the metaphysical, but it is just as mythic as any old story, as any religious text. And that's what we're seeing. And personally, I'm kind of frightened by that. I don't trust UFO cults, especially right now. I think that that's a danger that is arising with it. But yeah, I hope that touches a little bit on that. Kind of went off the rails.
I think it touches upon an interesting concept too, where that sort of mythic literalism is then taken and turned into its own religion, right? I think this is what we see when we talk about starseeds and like the starseed, all of the various different kinds of starseeds, right? That, you know, these individuals have been sent down from their respective people up above to bring the world light and this knowledge of their siblings and the stars. And you look at some of the scars that people have, both from the fairy abductions and also from various like UFO experiences. And I think we see sort of the same thing that happened with like this starseed community that has formed, especially on TikTok, as you mentioned. It's quite popular over there. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, as simple as everyone wants to feel special. You know, everyone wants to have something that makes them stand apart. I think that's a huge aspect of the starseed movement. I think that's the heart of it, because if the message was, I'm part alien and you humans are so much better, that wouldn't take off. You know what I mean? There's something special about it. But yeah, I think that the starseed stuff is so deeply new age, and it's deeply kind of consumerist as of spirituality. It's something where there's very little humility. I just have power just because I am who I am. And there's not a lot to dig into it. It's kind of surface level at most points. And when it's not, it generally tends to devolve into kind of just making up stuff and throwing out terms. And, you know, they kind of, you just don't get it. You're just not too spiritually inclined. And a lot of it doesn't have a great depth to it. It's very similar. I kind of view it as a sister practice to this very particular attempt at witchcraft on TikTok, where I don't have to do anything. I just gonna proclaim myself something and say I'm very powerful and don't mess with me. I know all these spells. And I think that's at the heart of it. It's people who want power, because we live in a very powerless world in a lot of ways. Sometimes these actual practices within occultism and spirituality and religion take years to develop. And who wants to sit around and do that?
So yeah, I think the instant gratification that permeates the occult community only feeds into those sort of more delusional engagements. And I was even thinking you'd made the connection between Annie and you two, like positive Protestantism and its influence on starseeds. And I was thinking about all the, like the light language videos that I've seen on TikTok where people are just speaking absolute gibberish. And it reminds me of a lot of like speaking in tongues that happens in some Pentecostal churches, where that's a sign of you being filled with the Holy Spirit. And in a very similar way, right, if you are somebody who's part of the starseed community and you're speaking the light language, like you were closer to your ancestors and therefore more powerful in the sense of being able to connect and like elevate people's vibrations and their energies and all of those things. It all speaks to this very main character syndrome that we see in the wider occult community, especially sort of running in New Age circles.
If we're talking about this in quite like a modern context, we've talked about sort of New Age, we've talked about the Fifth Great Awakening, which is sort of 70s onwards. I was actually wondering how far do these ideas around aliens go back in religious communities? Like, is this a modern phenomenon, or do we have examples? I know you've touched on Buddhism and how those can be read in a certain way, but do we have examples from the past where we can describe kind of things as perhaps ufology in an early sense?
I guess I would say arguably ufology in the way we term it now probably goes back into, well, I think maybe the start I would call it like modern ufology, or how we think about it, is I believe it was in the 1700s or 1800s. Probably 1800s America, there was the flying ships, like flying airship sightings all across the United States, people claiming these giant contraptions that are flying through it, and the people are rappelling down, and oh, I'm this so-and-so. So that, I think, is really the start of modern ufology in terms of study, and that really picks up in 1940s, 1950s, with all, you know, there's just so much, and then you kind of the heyday in the 60s, you know, 70s, John Keel and all these kind of very famous ufologists. But it, turning a little bit into the past, I think it's hard to say so, because I think it returns too much to spiritual and religious contexts. But I mean, it's very interesting because the planets take on a very different meaning in the past. You know, we're not thinking of them as places necessarily you can go and land on. There were little stories about that, but you know, I think it's interesting that when aliens come down, they say, I'm of Mars, I'm from Mars, right? Well, if you think about the old occult views, they are literally of Mars. They are of the astrological composition. They are almost elemental beings corresponding to different occult forces. They are angels. They are devils and demons and weird things, but they all kind of share that, again, going back to the archetypal structure. You can look at all these old cases and have this very similar profile. So maybe the easiest thing I can say is there's always been accounts of humans coming in contact with strange things that don't seem to be from here. That's the most basic I can say it.
I think you made a really good point when, you know, people, you hear these stories about aliens and they say, you know, I am from whatever planet. But yeah, if you think about it from like a Neoplatonic view, these correspondences are simply the resonances of like virtues, right? These occult virtues that would come down from the stars. Or if you read Alchemy, he talks about the stellar ray theories and how these spirits, you know, can come down into the world through these rays and impact the material world. That's an interesting thing where we are eisegetical in our understanding of these older descriptions, where we read in this modern terminology, these modern contexts into older stories without sort of the cultural and historical context of the time in which they were actually being interpreted. But it also reminds me, this whole topic reminds the stuff you see in the Enochian spheres and in some polemic circles where you have some people saying that the Enochian angels are aliens in their own sense, partially also because they have their own language, that it's not legible to the human ear. We don't really know how to say it. John Dee and Edward Kelly theoretically never spoke it. They simply wrote it down. I've seen in some ceremonial circles from some ufologists who have said that even like Aleister Crowley in his channeling of the book of the law, that AWOL, the spirit from which he received that information from, was in fact an alien, which I also think is very interesting. So we even see these things permeate the ceremonial sphere at times as well. Oh, yeah. Have you come across any of that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, AWOS is certainly alien. Now, not maybe a little green man from, you know, the Pleiades system or whatnot. But I mean, yeah, that Crowley and the Book of the Law is a very influential part of some modern ufology. I'll kind of go over to Alan Greenfield, and I would say just watch the series Hellier by Greg and Dana Newkirk to get more into it. But what's very, very interesting is that there is this part of the Book of the Law, which is a cipher. Crowley could not decipher it himself. He died without it being, you know, solved until one of his students did. What's very interesting is that when you apply this strange cipher to alien names, they start to have weird correspondences. That's why these aliens always have these, I am injured cold. You have these very weird Carl Otto and all these very, very odd names. And they're kind of like barbarous names. That's in some of the old texts, that weird, you plug this stuff in and they correspond. And again, I think that's where I kind of go back to maybe my own ideas, is that I don't think saying the old gods are aliens or aliens are the old gods, but I think if there is some truth to it, you're going to have an easier time finding it by going to the similarities, the archetypal similarities. I think it is interesting. Some magic, ceremonial magic, works with ufology. And that's kind of, I think, a groundbreaking thing right now. I mean, it's all trans-channeling. That's where most of the texts come from in the ancient world, and most of the modern ufology ones come from. I don't trust most of it, but some of it's really interesting.
There's an interesting discussion in a book I'm reading currently called Mind Over Magic by Richard Kaczynski. And he discusses the whole like cave metaphor that we see in a lot of Plato's work, right? And Ian talks about how the reason why caves are often associated with like mystical and metaphysical experiences is because you're submerged in the dark. The mind does crazy things when you're in the dark and you can't make out any sort of light. It brings about a lot of these sort of ecstatic experiences. And I think similar things happen with people who have those UFOs. There was a Pentagon employee who was a whistleblower, and earlier this year, I think it was May 2 of 2025, named Matthew Brown. And he talks about all of the sort of stuff that the government has all kinds of information on UFOs and so on and so forth. And he posted a tweet about a month after his episode. He got interviewed on a podcast called Weaponized, I believe it was. And he posted a tweet after that. And if you look at the images in this tweet, there's an actual image of the Enochian like tablet at the Sigillium, the outside lettering from which you can sometimes create a sigil. If you read like Juan Milo Duquette's book, he talks about sort of building this 3D basket from sort of the outer lettering that has all these names. And it was so interesting to me to see something like the Enochian Sigillium, those letters on the outside, as like part of this ufology, this person who you know, is a whistleblower from the Pentagon. I was just like, the connections are wild.
It is. I'll touch very briefly on that because I have a lot of takes. I would wager that the whistleblowers are not lying, but I don't believe they know what's actually going on. I think on my conspiracy theory tinfoil hat, I think the government and people in power, maybe I should say better, have a vested interest in having the public believe they know what's going on. I think that's always been the case. I think since the 50s, I don't believe the government knows what UFOs are. I think that drives them mad, probably. But also, there's a lot of evangelicals in power who do believe they're demons. And those who aren't, there are notable occultists, probably right now in the administration and the cabinets. We know, you know, Peter Thiel, and he does have stuff in occultism. He knows about it, Dark Enlightenment stuff. Bannon was an occultist too. He was, this stuff is really prevalent to know because a lot of it's dog whistles. I mean, I think the Enochian stuff was put in there for a very particular reason because it has stirred up a lot of people. I take that with a lot of grain of salt and a lot of suspicion, and I'll leave it at that.
So we've kind of touched on the idea of religions always being kind of retrofitted to have these UFO beliefs in. I wanted to ask a little bit about religions that actually explicitly have beliefs about extraterrestrials in. So things like Scientology, for example, what your thoughts are on those, how they fit into the para-ufology field, whether they are seen as sort of valid or whether they sort of considered to be a separate phenomenon.
All right, Scientology is both an easy and a hard one. What we know, L. Ron Hubbard was a half-baked occultist. He was an extremely good occultist, but he did not have the background. He was in correspondence with Crowley, never met him, I don't believe, but obviously there's more than enough information on Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard's work in the Babylon workings. The whole Xenu stuff and the whole story, you know, obviously South Park really blew that off and popularized it. That's the exoteric understanding of Scientology. That's what's known to the general membership. L. Ron Hubbard was a fiction writer. This is stuff that you can watch in his early, you can read in his early works that he's repurposing. People have every right to believe that, but I think that the core of Scientology is just Thelema kind of put on his head. It's the going clear, the whole chart is just the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, rebranded for the modern age. And at least according to one of L. Ron Hubbard's sons, which, you know, I'm sure Scientologists will say isn't valid. Who knows? There's a lot of beef, so who knows? But he claimed that Hubbard said that his goal was for all people to follow his will alone instead of everyone following their truth. I just think that Hubbard was very, very smart to latch on the ufology and the aliens and all of the space stuff at that time period that was becoming extraordinarily popular. I think that was a great business move. It's an easy crossover, but I don't think it's really, there's a lot of material there.
I will say, I've often thought that the going clear, like if you look at the chart, right, there's the 15 levels in the organization. I've often thought that it reminds me a lot of the 10 Sephiroth on the tree, but then also the four worlds. I could see it out to 14 and then, you know, one is like union with God. I've always thought there could be a connection there, especially with Ron Hubbard's connection with Jack Parsons and also.
Yeah, it's directly. It's the tree of life. They just claim that they have a surefire bridge to cross the abyss. And I wouldn't attempt it. I don't know how much I trust the bridge.
Good point. Fair enough.
I don't have the money to get it.
By Karanzon, right, in the abyss.
I don't have the money to get the pass over it either.
Well, one thing that I think was so funny in an ironic way when you were talking about like the different lands and Buddhism and different beliefs is it just made me realize just like how much stuff had been lifted from those beliefs into theosophy, which then gets directly transplanted into the New Age movement.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like we can't do an episode without talking about theosophy. But it's kind of, I mean, because I don't think Blavatsky herself necessarily viewed her theosophical realms as like alien realms, but I think people definitely do nowadays. It's just very, very interesting, like how people kind of took a religion that talks about other realms like theosophy, but wasn't explicit about aliens in the way that we see them. And then it kind of spiraled into like the starseed movements and other weird alien cults online.
Theosophy has a long history with Buddhism and how it has in many ways appropriated it. I think that's fine. I think a lot of it was genuine misunderstanding and genuine mistranslation. Again, I would do a whole podcast episode on this topic, but I will only briefly touch it. The Theosophists brought back the idea of tulpas from the Tibetans. No, they didn't. That wasn't a thing. Tulpas are not a Buddhist practice. There's a very particular one that is an advanced visualization in which one kind of builds this construct of a Buddha, Bodhisattva, for that entity, enlightened being to enter into, but that is very different from creating a living imaginary friend. I mean, the tulpa stuff is very interesting on its own. It's a topic I've done some work on, but it's not Buddhist as much as I kind of wish it was. That'd be really cool, but it's just not part of the tradition, and that's okay. The Theosophists can take this one.
I'm curious if you think, so earlier you were telling us a story about the Buddha who came down to from like one realm to learn from the other Buddha. Do you think there's something related between like that story and the Ascended Masters of Theosophy?
Probably. I mean, in Buddhism, yeah, there's ideas that there are enlightened beings all over the place. Many of the times, they may take different forms. I think you see that in the Enlightened Masters, you know, the secret chiefs that, you know, you never know who they might be. You never know who's a bodhisattva in disguise. So yeah, that's definitely a thing. I mean, especially in some of the more esoteric forms of Buddhism, which I'm not privy to. I don't have any empowerments to speak on. But, you know, there's definitely ideas that, you know, these are things people can do. You have stories of living Buddhist masters and gurus and Rinpoches who bilocate. And suddenly they were there, and then they're across the world and have an encounter with someone. I mean, this is the stuff of the Ascended Masters. So, I mean, it's not hard to see that. It's a very appealing thing for any religious group to think that this idea Elijah can appear as anyone, you know, and that's a thing. That's how the Ascended Masters work too, in a certain regard, depending on.
Yeah, well, you have the angels who appeared to Abraham and Sarah, but didn't. Like, they weren't actually angels. They were just in the form of men that Abraham took in and then was blessed with a child after. So, yeah, we see that in Christianity as well.
Even my favorite story, Luke, Jesus appears to the disciples, and they don't recognize him until it's too late. You know, yeah. So there's this thing about these hidden, enlightened beings that are a little cross-cultural. So I'm not surprised that the Theosophists kind of centralized them. It's interesting.
Aliens are just the ascended Theosophists.
They're doing weird things. I want to know why they want cows and what they're doing with them then.
Mm-hmm. We need both. I also want to know why they make corn mazes. Like, do those weird symbols in the fields.
Yeah, those are fun. It's just sigils. You don't see those much anymore. That's a shame. I guess they stopped funding the arts and the Alien Council or something.
Speaking of words and semantics, into the difference between extraterrestrial and ultra-terrestrial.
The easiest way to think of it is extraterrestrial implies it comes from, you know, somewhere outside of Earth. The classic idea is somewhere physically outside of Earth. It's something alien, outsiders entering into our world. Ultra-terrestrial, which I want to say John Keel coined, but it's possible there was an earlier usage of it. He definitely popularized it, though. The ultra-terrestrial is something that is already here, or at least exists on some similar touching plane of reality. Keel had the idea that these ultra-terrestrials were able to come into this world just in certain areas, zones of fear, call them thin spaces, window zones, these particular areas, and kind of cause havoc or deliver these strange messages. I believe it was actually in the Mothman Prophecies movie, great movie, I think, Richard Gere stars in it, that someone describes them as, how do they know these things? How do they, you know, sometimes they're usually very prophetic, these weird things happening. He describes them as window washers on a really high skyscraper. They says it can see from a different point the whole city. It's not necessarily more powerful or special, but the ultra-terrestrial has a different vantage point, and that's why it's really hard to communicate. I think in the movie they say, look, you're bigger than an ant, you know, you have a lot more knowledge than an ant. Why aren't you explaining the world to an ant? You know, that's the whole idea. You're not necessarily better or worse, but, you know, why are these encounters so weird? It says, well, they're trying, but the way they communicate is limited. That's a bit of a ramble, but yeah, the ultra-terrestrial notion is that they are not necessarily flesh and blood beings coming from other planets. They may be something a lot stranger coming from a lot stranger of a place. I think you can call anything aliens, ultra-terrestrials, deities could be understood by them too. There's something that exists. They're not from a different planet necessarily, but they are ultra-terrestrial alike. They're definitely, they fit the definition by just purely semantics. They're more than terrestrial, but they're not necessarily from somewhere else. They're right here.
What are some examples that you can, to be so frank, I've never heard of this term, like, ever. So when you even put that in the outline, I was like, what the heck is an ultra-terrestrial? What are we talking about here? And that explanation is unique, but it's so vague and a little bit ambiguous in the way that it's described. Are there like examples or things that people talk about that are ultra-terrestrial within sort of the modern world that you can share?
Sure. I think the archetypal ultra-terrestrial that in the modern age is a man, or maybe a man, by the name of Indrid Cold. Now, Indrid Cold, if you don't know, is, in my mind, one of the most fascinating parts of the Mothman prophecies events. I think the Mothman is way overhyped, just a weird bird thing flying around. But Indrid Cold is supposedly this man named Woodrow Derenberger is driving along the road, and this strange thing in the sky comes down. I don't think it was described like a flying saucer or a traditional UFO, but out comes this man. I don't think he ever saw exit. And he walks over to the car and he's grinning and he talks without moving his mouth, but his teeth are big and, you know, he looks like a human in some sense. And he says, you know, hello, my name is Indrid Cold. I come from a country much weaker than yours. And he starts talking to this guy telepathically and he's asking him weird questions. What's the population of the town? Blah, blah, blah. All these things that are, you know, he's not, oh, I come in peace. I'm an alien. He's just this very odd fellow. And eventually, what was it? I think he ends the conversation saying something like, I will see you in time. These very, very weird statements that are, I mean, they're alien, but they're not like what we think of them. So that's a very, very interesting case. And there's so much more to that. But I mean, the Men in Black are very interesting ultra-terrestrial-like entities. These are things that it's not an alien. It doesn't look like traditional accounts of a demon or a god. They're just these things that don't seem to fit here, but here they are. Maybe AWOS is a ultra-terrestrial in that sense. It's something outside of this place. I think that it's a great term because it really can fit most things, but it especially fits the stuff that doesn't have any other easily categorical thing. A modern ultra-terrestrial, Harlow. Harlow is an entity which the Newkirks, these paranormal researchers and occultists, talk to every Halloween using something called the Estes Method. And he's supposedly a surfing vampire from Saturn. And he talks, like, hey, dudes, gnarly, chill out. He keeps instructing them to build a surfboard at the center of your mind. You know, these phrases and stuff that are just like, what the hell is he talking about? And that's ongoing. This Halloween, they're doing some weird experiment where they think they figured out what he wants. They built something, and I'm very excited. But yeah, that's the whole thing, is that these are things that are weird. They're still contacting people, and they're still around. They're just really weird. That's the best way I can put it in terms of, like, what's the difference? That, you know, it's not little gray men. It's weirdos. Ultra-terrestrial weirdos.
So you're touching on how this group have sort of built something to perhaps appease surfing vampire. And I thought that would be a good opportunity to transition to our next topic, which is UFO cults, which you briefly alluded to earlier. What your thoughts are on these, whether they are to be trusted, what their background is. Basically, free-for-all for you to discuss these.
Are they to be trusted? Generally, no. I would not trust a UFO cult. I would not trust anything that feels like a cult in general. But I think that's obvious. I'm very distrustful of most New Age things. I think that they cherry pick a lot and there's not a lot of substance to them. I think at worst, they are sometimes detrimental to one's spiritual practice overall. But yeah, UFO cults scare me. I think there's something we're going to see a lot more of in the future. I'm particularly scared of, again, this is definitely more my tinfoil hat, state-endorsed or state-funded UFO cults or federal government-funded. I think that's the fear. I think if I'm reaching, you know, don't think I'm saying this is happening right now. But I mean, theoretically, you know, if they want a state religion, that's the way to do it. Or, you know, one that's controlled, where people are less religious than ever now. And UFOs and this idea of, hey, there are these other beings, and the government says we're talking to them, that's scary. I think a lot of people are going to find a lot of comfort in that. Like I said, in the secular age. And I think the more and more we see UFO cults, I want to know where they're getting their money from. I think there's a lot of opportunity for bad actors in very powerful positions to use them for whatever nefarious purposes, especially if they charge you. That's always the good case. If you're asking for money, that's unreasonable. Steer away. And probably find something for free.
We talked about this in our New Age episode. There's a massive overlap between evangelicals and New Age and the ultra right, and many people online who are into UFO cults. Who do they tend to support? They tend to support the right. And some of them even believe that Trump is some light being who has come from an alien world to save them. So it definitely is a thing. It sounds like parody, but it's not.
It does.
I know.
It's ridiculous. It's interesting, though, between like the connection between the evangelicals and the UFO cults. I mean, if you think about what they have in common, it's the rapture, in essence. They're talking about the same thing. I think when you think about like that's sort of the end times, that's what they were looking towards. And as we get into a world that's considerably bleaker and bleaker every single day, I think more people are going to be looking towards that. And if they don't want to find it in religion because of whatever reason, trauma, or they just don't like it, they don't want to be, believing in things that couldn't possibly exist. Well, UFOs have some more scientific legitimacy, frankly, than like most religions, including Christianity at this point. So that's sort of the materialistic option for people nowadays.
I think of all high strangeness, UFOs have a very big leg up on them in terms of believability to the average person. You know, we have planes. We know the government has made secret aircraft and passed them off as UFOs. Mirage Man, there's a documentary. It's pretty good. It's the rational man's high strangeness, if you will. Maybe followed only by Bigfoot. The people who still believe Bigfoot is a hidden primate somewhere. That's almost as respectable. Almost.
I have sort of a separate question that wasn't in the document at all, but there's recently been a big rise in AI cults as well.
Yeah.
And I've seen things on various platforms, both Instagram, Fel's over here shaking her head like, no. on Instagram and TikTok, where people talk about how artificial intelligence is simply a higher vibration that is allowing for alien intelligence to essentially take hold and truly make it artificially intelligent.
Sorry, I just need the listeners to see everybody. You can't see this, but everybody is facepalming in the chat right now.
What are you talking about? I've been reading off ChatGPT this whole time.
Oh, man, I've been talking to a robot the whole time.
That's a joke for the audience, by the way, just in case. If you want to be as charitable to that crowd as possible, I do think that AI is a great insight into the collective unconscious of people. I think it is essentially averages out everything into the most kind of common denominator, depending on who's tweaking it. You can never trust it necessarily because someone's always behind the pilot seat. But in its purest form, there's interesting discussion on that. But again, I don't believe in AI. It's an algorithm. It's a word processor that's just guessing. It's not intelligent. So I don't believe that. It's programmed to make you happy, to affirm you. So, I mean, of course, you spit anything into it long enough, it's going to agree with you. I think that's fairly common knowledge. I have a little work I'm working on. I'd like to put out eventually. I called calling it the new Ring of Solomon. That I'm like, look, if you don't have the Ring of Solomon, you have these kind of discerning critical thinking skills, the AI is like demons or daemons. You know, you can ask them to build the temple, but if you don't have the self-knowledge and the self-will to control them, they're going to get you. AI will manipulate you. No, I'm not saying it's actual demons. It's analogy, to be clear. And I don't believe that higher intelligences are contacting us through AI. Frank Sutton made these things called the Frank's Box, and they're basically spirit boxes, but they also have like live electromagnetic. They capture like the electromagnetic field live and translate it. Really weird shit. I mean, again, the Newkirks. I keep referring to them because I think they're doing some of the best work in this field right now. They just had a podcast episode all about it, but about the Frank's Box. He got the instructions how to build them from aliens. He had dreams. He had visions. They would contact him through broken radio, and he didn't even know what he was building, and it worked. So, I mean, again, you know, I always keep a skeptic grain of salt here, but if you're trying to contact things, there's cooler ways to do it than ChatGPT. Come on. At least put some effort into it. That's my thought.
Yeah, you tell. Back in my day, we used to have Ouija boards.
Back in my day, we waited for the aliens to tell us to build some cryptic device.
This is interesting. I know we're kind of winding down, but Henny, like, what? I know there are UFO cults in England, but I feel like they're in some ways distinctive from American ones. I feel like the ones in England are less cults and more of like kind of like individual weirdos. I don't know. Whereas America, it seems to be grounded in a weird cultural way. I don't know.
I would say, from my limited experience, because we tend to be more secular as a nation, the UFOlogy tends to be a little bit more sort of scientized and less paranormal in nature. So it tends to be a little bit less sort of worshipful who are... There is a paranormal element to it, I suppose, but it's not so much geared towards this kind of like rapture deity idea. It's more like very fringe science sort of approach to things. Whereas I think in the US, there's like this sort of cultural religiosity, which is really interesting, that sort of permeates everything.
Before I pop off, I want to hear your recommendations on like podcasts, or you've already mentioned a couple of documentaries and books and stuff where people can go to for more information. You're the expert here.
That book, Supernatural, that's a really good one talking about that phenomena. I'm a big fan of Greg and Dana Newkirk and the Newkirk Museum of the Paranormal, Haunted Objects podcast. They're podcast documentary series Hellier. I think that's probably some of the best stuff you're going to get for that paraufology and a more rational, grounded approach. It starts with goblins, but stick through it. It's really cool. The Mothman Prophecies by John Keel, I think, really is a seminal text in terms of high strangeness and ufology. The Silver Bridge, anything by Alan Greenfield, They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers is a book. There's a lot. I would just say that go back to the past a little bit. I don't trust a lot of the whistleblowers. I would not go there. You know, I would not go to the podcast with some of these people. Look to the past. I think you'll find a lot more information. Saucer and Saucerers by Alan Greenfield is a great historical text on early ufology, and you can kind of know some of the big names. That's a good place to start.
Yeah, go back to the ufology golden days, which is like the 50s to the 70s.
Yeah.
Like, history is really going to be where you want to look.
Because I truly, if you look at it, it's hilarious. The stuff that's being talked about is breaking news right now. Ufologists are like, yeah, we've been talking about this stuff since 66. You know, this is old school stuff. I mean, this is not new. So yeah, go back to some of the golden age and go to people who are somewhat skeptical. I mean, you can just use some discernment because you can tell who's trying to pitch you a message. Just, you know, use your mind, use your brain, take it all with a grain of salt. You know, I believe in some weird shit, but I don't like believing in other people's weird shit. So just take it as it goes.
Okay, final question to close us out. Do you guys believe in aliens?
I believe in ultra-terrestrials.
Okay.
If you're talking about life on other planets, I think statistically, yes. But I doubt that physical life forms have traveled to Earth. I think maybe on a meteorite, but I do not think that I am not a nuts and bolts-er, let's put it that way. So, yes, but no.
I'm very much in the same position where I believe statistically speaking, it's probably very likely, but in terms of like the sort of physical material experience things, I have quite significant doubts about that. And I think, yeah, basically in line with what Levi was saying.
Yeah, I don't. I think something we talked about earlier, which is actually more of sort of how I align, is that I think a lot of the alien discussion in like the modern day has been a misunderstanding of like ancient terminology when we're referring to different things. We're talking about, you know, I am from said planet, but it being referenced more to this like occult virtue of things. That's really how I interpret how aliens have been then just like taken and run with in some really crazy directions. I think life maybe does exist on other planets, but I think it's mostly microbiological life. I don't really think that we're talking like other whole species and stuff.
I'm the same, where I definitely agree that there are, like, I think statistically it makes sense that there's life on other planets. I don't know if they can contact us, and like things that are contacting us, I don't think are flesh and blood aliens. I
thought of one more book. So last one I'll give. Carl Jung has a book on UFOs and flying saucers. I think that should be required reading if you want to do this, because there's a lot there that I think gives great explanation.
And with that, I think our bingo is complete for things that are mentioned in every...
Wait, no, Pythagoras.
I know, having a Pythagoras for once.
Cycles back.
We'll probably recommend Carl Jung in a positive light. All right, with that, we'll go ahead and close it out. Thanks so much for being on, Levi. This was such a great discussion. So much better than I thought it was going to go, to be so honest. It was really, really
awesome.
We will link Levi's socials and everything below in addition to the things that he's talked about during this episode for you to look at in your own time. With that, thanks, everybody. We'll see you next episode. Bye.